I call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson. Chair Cotiza Watoon. Cotiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Present.
Representative Dabney.
Dabney present.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Representative Haley.
Haley present.
Representative Kegel.
Present.
Representative Lee. Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Listlegard.
Listlegard present.
Oh, I think I got muted there. Representative Lucero.
Caffeine in hand. Happy Wednesday afternoon.
Perfect. Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Farr present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice.
Tice present.
And Representative Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Members, we have a quorum present. First on the order of business, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 8th, 2022?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Dabney moves approval of the minutes for March 8th, 2022. Members, do we have any discussion to that motion? Hearing none, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 8th, 2022 are approved. First on today's agenda is House File 3513. Representative Kegel, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to move House File 3513 to be recommended to be referred to the Early Childhood Committee.
Representative Kegel moves House File 3513 be recommended to be referred to the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. We have two amendments to get the bill in the shape the author would like us to consider. Representative Kegel, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Sure. So, Madam Chair, I move the A1 amendment. What the A1 amendment does is adds gold plans as well as silver plans to the bill.
Members, any discussion to the A1? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Kegel, would you like to move and describe your A2 amendment?
Sure. The A2, I would move the A2 amendment. And what this amendment does is it changes the implementation date to November 1st, 2023, removes the sunset, and then also moves a reporting piece to 2024.
Right. Members, any discussion to the A2? Representative O'Driscoll.
There we go. Thank you, Madam Chair. We can either discuss it now or at the time that we discuss the bill once it's been through the hearing. Just wondering why we are deleting the sunset on this particular bill. I assume that the date changes are because we've asked questions in the past about kind of refreshing these bills as they're being brought to the committee, but I was taken aback a little bit by the fact that we also are sunsetting, and maybe the author, if she wants to address it now or at the time that we discuss the bill. Either way, I'd just like to have a little bit more background for the committee on that. Either way, it's fine with me.
Representative Kegel, would you like to address that now or later?
Sure, I can do it now. So thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative O'Driscoll, after meeting with the folks from Minsure, it seemed like it was tougher to set up the system and then take it down. And so I think this is a really, really good idea. And I think our child care workers really need this. And so I don't see why we would want to get rid of it after just 1 year, especially when we make the investments to build up a system like this. And so that was kind of just the idea behind removing the sunset.
Representative Cagle for the explanation.
Right. Members, any further discussion to the A2? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
And any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Cagle, to your bill as adopted, as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. So this is a bill that would give additional premium subsidy to childcare workers. As you can tell right now, I don't have a three-year-old hanging off of me or Paw Patrol in the background. And that's because of the wonderful ladies over at Learn and Grow Childcare Facility in Blaine. And so they just do a wonderful job. But I know it's difficult work, and I know that they don't get paid as much as they should, which always baffles me because, you know, I write those checks every week. And so it's it's a tough business model to get into and sustain. And so what this would do is this is really a worker's bill. This is a bill because we know that our childcare workers are the workforce behind our workforce. And so many women have not gone back into the workforce because work doesn't pay enough to cover childcare. Childcare programs are lacking space. They can't hold on to employees. And so this I see as just one little piece of a puzzle that would help attract and retain workers into the childcare industry. Section 1, Subdivision 1 is definitions. That Subdivision 2 is eligibility of the program. And so if you're making less than 300% of the federal poverty guidelines, you accept all federal and state premium tax credits that they're eligible for, and you are ineligible for Minnesota Care, then that gap between the that gap would be filled then by this premium care a subsidy. And so that's really just kind of the basis behind this. And so with that, I would like to turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. First on the list, we have Carlos Kapansky. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi there. I have to unmute myself. As you can see, I'm in my attire. Welcome to my little world here.
Thank you.
I got to put you guys into my little holder here where you can actually view. Okay. Good day, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having me and members of the committee. I'm very proud of the fact that you're taking the time to look at child care providers as professionals in this venue. So they truly are the backbone of our community. And let me introduce myself. My name is Carla Sipsky. I was a child care provider in Greater Minnesota for about 15 years when I raised my children in my home and took care of several other families. In our situation, my farming husband paid the health care premium and I carried all the other expenses. After running for state office, I assisted in directing several centers in the St. Cloud area, holding several teacher positions, hearing and attract the issue with attracting and keeping people in the profession and how it was failing. This is because when I worked in the early childhood area in these center-based programs, I wasn't even making what McDonald's was making of $15 an hour. And that's their starting wage. Currently, I teach in the St. Cloud Technical College on the Develop DHS platform as an American Heart Association instructor and throughout all of Greater Minnesota. We are a close-knit early childhood community. In these classrooms, educators share the retention issues and how those that forego the low income really have a difficult time holding on to this profession. That was me. I worked that profession for 15 years, and then I also went on to help in these center-based programs. I truly fear the instability with caregivers on our little learners and their mental health because of this issue. This is why I need to be before there for many providers and directors to continue my support with weekly mandated classes. I help them out in all areas of Minnesota, keeping their team certified as they enjoy the idea that I have walked in their shoes. As an instructor, you can imagine I try to diffuse many stressors providers have in my class safe space. They struggle with trying to continue for many reasons, but it is truly the bottom line, including the financial instability that they have to forego. Trying to keep themselves healthy with very other expenses, including their health care. Providers are expected by parents and employers to be available Monday through Friday all day, and many do not have a backup plan. Yet the pandemic, now the teachers strike. Without them, well, you see what's happening to healthcare providers. So it's kind of an honor to see that the governor is coming at providers and childcare and actually taking the time to put this together. Without this plan and going forward with it, we will have providers dropping out of the programs even more. Currently, the struggle as it is, as I talk to providers throughout the state of Minnesota. And I'm telling you, every week I have contact with them as I teach in their homes. So the children are our future, folks. So we got to put our mouth where our money where our mouth is, because our governor has already said that it's important that providers take these children in. So we're willing to do it. Kids, they're our future. So we want to make something happen with this. So thank you so much for hearing me today. And as you can see, I got to get back to work. But if you have any questions, I am more than happy to answer any questions at this time.
Thank you so much, Ms. Skopansky, for joining us. Next on the list, I have Becky Wojtaszek. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Becky Wojtaszek. I'm with Love and Learn Childcare Academy. With the healthcare, we're having problems retaining our teachers. They are leaving because we cannot offer health insurance. We did look at health insurance, and it would literally sink us if we had to offer it to our teachers. Number one, they would not be able to afford it, and number two, the center can't afford it either. So having health insurance is a big thing. Our teachers are around children that are sick, and they need to keep themselves healthy, and if they can't go in and get seen, then we're closing down rooms. Trying to keep rooms open, we need teachers in them. Right now, we are short teachers. We could open up more spots if we had teachers available. But every teacher coming in is asking us about health insurance, especially with the pandemic. They really need health insurance. For a center, what comes in for money is all that can go out, and we can only charge parents so much money for them to be able to afford it. They cannot afford us to be raising up their rates $5 or $10 a week. Some of our parents are on the brink of already not being able to afford paying anything, which means we cannot pay our teachers more for them to afford to go out and get the health insurance. So we really need it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ms. Wojtaszek. Next, I have Sharla Atar-Saheli. Sorry for mispronouncing your name. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Sharla Atar-Saheli, and I'm also owner of Love and Learn Childcare Academy. Yeah, right now our teachers cannot afford health insurance. We have gotten a few of them on MinSure, but still with that, some of them don't even qualify, so they're working without health insurance. I mean, like for my husband and myself, we both work here at the center. We're both on MinSure, so that should tell you as an owner, childcare isn't making any money if an owner is on MinSure. So for our teachers, we have tried health insurance, like Becky had said, but some of our teachers, because of their age, would have to pay $1,000 a month premium. And that's almost their whole paycheck, and they can't do that. And we get new teachers in every time. They want benefits. We cannot offer them. We tried. And so they choose to go to other places that can offer the benefits that they're looking for, because they're young families having children. So they need to have something, because most of the people in childcare are women. And so they need that extra support. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your testimony. That is our list of testifiers today. So we will move to member questions and discussion. Seeing none. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Cagle. I share your concern about the difficulty with health insurance rates. Do you know, I know you don't have a fiscal note available, but in your research for the bill, do you have any idea of the number of child care providers that aren't qualified identifying underinsured or and kind of the scope, even though you don't have the fiscal note back, how many providers would be on this program?
Representative Cagle.
Madam Chair and Representative Haley, I don't know that offhand. I would actually have to do some digging. I know that there is a comparable program in Washington State, and of that, there was not very many people that actually fell between that that 200 to 300. So, and actually, Washington doesn't have the Minnesota Care program like we do here in Minnesota, and so it looks like their numbers would be a bit higher, but it looks like they had, let me see, qualified health plans, 400 in the new child care premium assistance program under 300 federal poverty. I think they also, though, have a lot more people that would qualify for it because theirs is voluntary. And so, you know, I think that's a really good question, and I'm kind of excited to see what the fiscal note says and see how many people that this could really, really help. I know it's going to be a small subset of people, but that's an important subset of people that really, you know, make it so that me and Carly can go to work.
Representative Haley, follow-up?
No follow-up. Thank you, Representative Cagle.
Members, any further discussion? Then, Representative Cagle, I will give you the last word on House File 3513.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You know, this is a really good bill, and I'd love to see this program, you know, go beyond child care workers. But I think this is the industry right now where we have a big crisis, and we've had a crisis for a while. And like I said, this is just one piece of the puzzle. And, you know, I think about the people that work at my child care center and all the bodily fluids that they deal with every day. I have a 3-year-old in potty training right now, so you can imagine that. And so whenever I drop my kiddo off, I am just so thankful for those wonderful people taking care of our little ones. And so I think that that's what we need to do is take care of those people taking care of our little ones. So thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. Representative Cagle renews her motion that House File 3513, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson. Chair Stevenson. Chair Cotizza-Watoon.
Aye.
Cotizza-Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, no.
O'Driscoll, no. Representative Barr.
No.
Barr, no. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson, aye. Representative Davney.
Davney, aye.
Davney, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, no.
Haley, no. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Listlegard.
Listlegard, aye.
Listlegard, aye. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, no.
Lucero, no. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
Farr, no.
Farr, no. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, no.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Tice.
Tice, no.
Tice, no. And Chair Stevenson.
Members, there being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 3513, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee. Next on today's agenda, we have House File 3400 from Representative Hollins. I will move that House File 3400 be recommended to be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Hollins, welcome to Commerce, and please proceed.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for having me today. This legislation came out of a work group that was formed several years ago that included many stakeholders like UCC attorneys, the business community, the AG's office, the Office of Minnesota Secretary of State. It was heard in Commerce in 2020, just before the pandemic ramped up, and so we weren't able to follow up with it. But this bill is a version of the pre-filing remedy used in at least 24 other states in the U.S. It will allow the Office of Secretary of State staff to set aside bogus, harassing, or retaliatory liens that are filed with the office. Many of these harassing liens are filed against public officials, correctional officers, law enforcement, judges, etc. The bill gives the Office of the Secretary of State discretion to reject clearly fraudulent business filings. And if someone believes that their filing was improperly rejected, there would be a process to appeal that decision. Alternatively, if staff miss a filing that was fraudulent, there's also a process for someone to have the office remove that filing as well. The Minnesota County attorneys are supportive of this bill and plan to testify. I believe we have one of them here today, and we have several other testifiers. And I will turn it over to them.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. First on the testifiers list, we have Michelle Zander Fisher. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chair, is it possible that we could switch the order?
Absolutely, Ms. Freeman. We will skip to Nicole Freeman. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair and members. My name is Nicole Freeman. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Office of the Secretary of State. I'm going to provide just a little more context to the bill and some history, and then we'll go to the other testifiers who have personal and professional experience with these situations. Thank you again to Representative Hollins for offering this bill. It's a pleasure to be with all of you today. I'm sure when most people think about the Office of the Secretary of State, they think about elections, as we do serve as the Chief Election Administrator. However, what most people don't know is that a majority of our staff, they work in the Business Services Division and they process various business filings. And that's what brings us here today to talk about House File 3400. The bill's language was created by a coalition. As Representative Hollins mentioned, the Attorney General's office was also involved. We also were in contact with federal law enforcement around a portion of these filings too. So the Business Services Division regularly files UCC liens, which are legal notices filed with our office where the filer has a security interest against a debtor. And the office essentially acts as a filing cabinet. So we file any filing that is in proper form. It becomes public right after we redact any 9-digit numbers, as those might be a social security number. Now, it wouldn't be a problem if we didn't routinely receive clearly fraudulent business filings. However, we do, and the filings come in a form that have many common characteristics and are pretty easy for our staff to pick out. These are retaliatory or harassment in nature and are most commonly filed against public officials, correction officers, law enforcement, and other judges. There's also something called strawman filings, and I don't know if many of you are familiar with the sovereign citizen movement, but sovereign citizens believe that the federal government has a strawman account at the U.S. Treasury Department representing the monetary worth of every citizen. These accounts supposedly contain anywhere between $600,000 and $3 million, and they believe that this UCC lien filing is the first step in accessing that those dollars. It might seem like a relatively harmless filing, but what we found out from our conversations with the FBI and the Attorney General's office is that this strawman filing is just the foundational document for other forms of fraud, including mortgage fraud and other retaliatory and harassment filings that are filed at later dates. So right now when our office receives a clearly fraudulent business filing, we don't have any authority to use discretion to reject these filings. whether it's at the time of the filing or after the fact. And this bill serves to give us some tools to address that. So right now, in order for someone to learn that they have one of these liens filed against them, they often don't learn that that's the case until they go to make a large purchase, like a home or apply for a car loan. And then in that process, it's discovered that they have this lien against them. Once they've discovered that this lien is filed against them, a private citizen has to go to court, has to retain a lawyer, and go to court and go through a court process in order to get these liens removed before those loans could be closed. For example, closing on a house. House File 3400 gives our office, the Secretary of State's office, discretion to set aside clearly fraudulent business filings. And in the event someone believes their filing is improperly rejected, there's a process to appeal that decision. Alternatively, if we miss a filing that was fraudulent, there's a process for someone to have the office remove that filing at a later date. As the author mentioned, this bill is a version of a pre-filing remedy that's used in over 24 other states. And these pre-filing remedies were first passed over 12 years ago. And as more and more states are adopting them, we're seeing an increase in these fraudulent filings coming from other states, either online or through the mail, to Minnesota, who still doesn't have a pre-filing remedy on books. The office would like to cut down on this fraud, not just for the efficiency of our office, but also for the victims. We want to relieve this burden for everyday citizens, and that's precisely what this bill does. It's not a cure-all, but it will definitely reduce the occurrences of this fraudulent filings. In committee as well is Trudy O'Maro. She's the UCC supervisor in the office, and she can help answer any technical questions. And then the next two testifiers, both county attorneys, can testify to personal and professional impacts that these bogus filings have had on them. And with that, I will turn it over to the next testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Now I will call Michelle Zander-Fisher. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Michelle Zander-Fisher, and I come before the committee today to urge support for this bill as a private citizen, as a county attorney, as the president-elect for MCAA, and to give voice to private citizens who have experienced fraudulent UCC financing statements being filed against them. As was just stated, currently anyone can file a UCC financing statement against another person, thus in simple terms, creating a lien against their property. No notice is required to the identified debtor, and the Secretary of State's office does not have the authority to reject obviously fraudulent liens. While the vast majority of the Secretary of State filings are proper, there are those individuals who file a statement for fraudulent purpose and for the sole purpose of harassing and intimidating individuals. Who are the individuals that are filing these fraudulent documents in my experience? They can be criminal defendants who file fraudulent liens against prosecutors, law enforcement, and judges. They can be individuals with disagreements against public officials, such as county administrators, county commissioners, state officials, and city officials. And they can be individuals who just have disagreement with other private individuals. In each scenario, the simple payment of a filing fee allows these individuals to file a financing statement against another person without having any valid claim or even notice to the affected individuals, creating a cascade of potential personal issues, all done, again, for purposes of intimidation and harassment. And I'd offer the committee the following example. There is an individual who has filed UCC financing statements against private individuals, county officials in at least two different counties, city officials, and state officials as a result of a family matter that actually commenced long ago. In each instance, he has filed UCC financing statements against the individuals that he perceives as having wronged him or thwarted his action to file other fraudulent documents. He actually started in another county before coming to Nicollet County and filed there against county officials and judicial system officials. He next moved to Nicollet County to file against county-owned property before targeting individual county officials, including commissioners, myself, and the county administrator. After those UCC financing statements were expunged, he then moved on to target state officials and again filed against individual Niklet County officials. His targeting expanded then to certain city officials after they took action in their official capacities. In each instance, public resources had to be expended by the government entities to expunge the financing statement on behalf of the public officials. It required expenditure of resources by the court to process the paperwork and expunge the records, and then, of course, for the Secretary of State's office to act upon that expungement. This takes away from other tasks and resources for those systems. Because of the current status of the filing system at the Secretary of State's office to being required to continue to accept filings by this individual, I now must conduct a monthly search of the Secretary of State's UCC filing database on an ever-growing list of people to ensure no filings have occurred. That search is conducted by individual target, not by the debtor, because there is no, by the filer, because there is no way to search only by his name. This legislation would change that practice so that the Secretary of State's office can reject further filings by this individual. The public officials that I just described have legal counsel available to them through the county attorney's office, the attorney general's office, or other counsel to take steps needed to expunge these liens. Private individuals do not have this resource. This same individual that I referenced above has filed similar liens against three other families. Ironically, I just spoke to one of them yesterday, coincidentally, and explained that I could not help them address the fraudulent filings, and they would have to retain legal counsel to file paperwork in Ramsey County District Court to expunge the liens. It is time, money, and emotional distress for these individuals, all because of the perpetual filings of this individual. I've lost count of the number of liens this individual has filed, at least five series of liens in Niklet County alone. And I say series of liens because in each instance, it involved more than one lien that was filed. He's just one person. In another case connected that's happened in here in Niklet County is a criminal defendant who has multiple open criminal files, and he's taken to filing fraudulent liens against any judge that handles a file involving him. I believe he's now at four judges. This creates issues of recusals and amounts to outright attempts to intimidate and harass judges. In these instances, the Attorney General's office has to expend the resources when judges are involved. When these liens are filed against public officials, the actions really impact their personal financial lives involving their families. While it requires public resources to have these financing statements expunged, the additional adverse impact to their personal life can be significant. Because there's no notice required to the purported debtor, the existence of these fraudulent liens can go unidentified until real estate is being sold or other financing option is taken. In fact, it is my understanding that's how the other county involved in the scenario that I described became aware of it. Someone in the group that he targeted was trying to sell his house. It can throw the financial situation of the purported debtor into chaos, and that is the goal of the filing. For private individuals, it can have even a greater impact. Imagine an individual who is trying to obtain financing in these very volatile financial times, only to discover a fraudulent lien. The individual's financial need must be put on hold for at least 2 months so that the person can hire a lawyer, file the paperwork. The paperwork makes its way through the court system, and that paperwork then sent back to the Secretary of State's office to be processed. It amounts to significant waste of resources on multiple levels. As outlined, the proposed bill would give individuals I referred to above the ability to challenge the filing by filing an affidavit without having to have a lawyer. It is fundamental that the system that is used to harass innocent people not cause further harm to those same individuals. Currently, the Secretary of State's office must stand idle in the face of known fraudulent filings. The proposed bill would give the Secretary of State's office the ability it currently lacks to reject those obviously fraudulent filings, thus minimizing the impact on the system as a whole. And I would stand for any questions of the committee, and I thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you, Ms. Zender-Fisher. Finally, we have Mark Ostrom. with Olmsted County. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Good afternoon. It's Mark Ostrom. I'm the Olmsted County attorney. I appreciate the opportunity to share a few thoughts with you. I echo the very articulate comments that Ms. Fisher, Zender Fisher made. She has done a great job of outlining what the problem is that we've kind of shared with our friend from, I believe, Nicollet County, although Michelle and I disagree on where he actually belongs. I want to just share just a little bit about what really happened with us. It came to light here in Olmsted County before it came to light in Nicollet County. And it did come to light very kind of incidentally. We became aware of this, these filings. And it actually started to occur here because in Olmsted County, we refused to record the judgments that he wanted to file in our recorder's office. And hence, everybody that touched that refusal to file became a target for this filing, this UCC filing. One of the things I want to also articulate is how obvious these things are that they're fraudulent. For example, I was one of the people he was filing against, and he called me and collectively called us all deep state traitors. Now, that would be a flag that would make some of these things very obvious. We're also referred to as racketeers. And the sums that he's asking for, or these fraudulent filers are asking for, are often exorbitant funds that really have no basis in common sense. So when we think about the Secretary of State's office ability to recognize a fraudulent filing on its face, often it's really that obvious. What we had to do to track this down, first of all, we had to call the Secretary of State's office and ask to do a search. Initially, they were going to charge us $25 per person to search. We finally asked for some professional courtesy and asked them to waive the fee so we could even figure out how broad this filing was, at which point then we had to, kind of track down, see if we could undo the filings, which Secretary of State's hands were absolutely tied. We hired outside counsel because I and two other attorneys in my office were targets of this, a couple members of the sheriff's department, people in the recorder's office, and I think three of our commissioners were all targets. So we hired outside counsel because it's a conflict of interest. We had to prepare filings in Ramsey County, which is not, it's not that far away for us, but it's not convenient, and had to go through the whole civil process to have these things undone. I just asked, and my staff tells me that we paid approximately $5,000 to our attorney to undo this. Now, I'm not going to lie. We get a fairly good discount because we do a lot of business with this firm, and we were handling, for this particular one, I think 10 different people. So we wrapped it up, 10 people for $5,000. But as Michelle has indicated, a private person would probably incur at least that much to undo it for just one person. This is, and they wouldn't have a clue how to do it. Frankly, we went to a well-known firm, somebody that is well-versed in this type of actions, and we're able to do it fairly swiftly and easily. Not every attorney is in this practice and is well-versed enough to even know what to do. I can't imagine what a private person would end up having to incur in something like this. As Michelle said, we also do random checks. I don't know if it's monthly or bi-monthly or quarterly, random checks with the Secretary of State's office to see if this guy has continued to file on a different name or something like that. He has refiled a bunch of new documents just this past January. He's not trying to file them now with the Secretary of State's office because he was thwarted there. This guy was. He's filing them. He's apparently created his own recorder's office in some sense. So this guy is clearly not giving up. He's doing it just to harass, just simply because we refused to record his earlier judgments that were bogus on its face. We recognize that and refuse to accept them. It's a very important tool that the Secretary of State's office really needs to have. I've read through it. There's an opportunity for a filer, if it is truly legit, to be heard on that and to perfect their filing if in fact it is really true. But the vast majority of these are absolutely false. They're false on their face. They're fraudulent, and they are so obvious that almost anybody at the Secretary of State's office, would recognize that. Folks, I would urge you to consider this bill. I appreciate the opportunity to be heard, and I also appreciate Michelle's comments. She was very articulate. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ostrom, for sharing this frustrating experience with us. We will move to member discussion and questions while I await members to raise their hand here on Zoom. I do have a question, actually, to maybe, I don't know, Representative Hollins, if you're able to answer it, or perhaps one of the testifiers, but it's been said that, like, most of the time these liens aren't found until there is some sort of real estate sale that's been introduced. But, I mean, if you Google yourself, are you able to find it? Is there a way that you know, could we go to the Secretary of State's website and, like, search ourselves to see if somebody has filed a claim on us? And I'm guessing, you know, the majority of Minnesotans don't know of this tool if something like this does exist. So just curious. Representative Hollins.
Sorry, I'm trying to follow protocol. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I believe there is a way that you can look into it. It's just that typically people don't do it until they absolutely have to. And I don't know if Nicole wanted to add anything to that.
Thank you, Representative Ms. Freeman.
My apologies, Chair. Thank you. Yes, there is a tool on the Secretary of State's website on our business services page where you can search by name and search for your name for those things. Yeah.
Thank you very much. So to the members of the public who are watching along today, you can go scope it out, make sure that nothing is going on. Representative Lucero, you are the first with your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is to the bill author. So I will just draw the bill author's attention to page number 5, beginning on line 5.19, through 5.22, there's a sentence that starts about halfway through line 5.19. The office has no duty to inform a belief as to whether a record was communicated or caused to be communicated with the intent to harass or defraud the person identified as the debtor or for another unlawful purpose, and has no duty to investigate or ascertain facts relevant to whether the intent or purpose was present. My question is, could the bill author just, I think I understand what this means, but I'm just seeking to have the bill author clarify with certainty what this means and how it relates to the bill, how this provision relates to the bill as a whole.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lucero, for the question. I think that's a fair question. My understanding is that it is there because the idea is not that the staff is necessarily passing judgment on whether or not what the intent is of something that is happening, and instead they're just simply flagging the things that come through and moving them to a separate pile. And I believe I see Ms. Freeman nodding along with that, but if she has anything to add, does that help you?
Representative Lucero, do you have any follow-up or?
Thank you. Yeah. So, and the reason I'm asking is what was in my mind is just taking the background of when I went through law enforcement school. When a law enforcement officer engages in reasonable suspicion to pull somebody over, for example, or engages in a probable cause arrest, we always need to be able to articulate with specific facts the reasoning behind what we did. So, I mean, that's just what was in my mind as I was reading this provision. And so it causes me pause if there's explicit language that says there's no duty to have to specifically articulate or justify, right, the rationale, the reason behind taking an action. That just causes me pause. And that was the reason for my question. So,
Representative Hollins?
Yeah, thank you. I completely understand where you're coming from. And I guess to create a similar analogy, it would be this is a situation where if in law enforcement you see somebody not signaling and they make the turn, we're not asking if there's, like, what the cause is, or, like, maybe they're on their phone or they were distracted or the kid's yelling. We're not looking into that. We're just saying, this is being flagged because this thing showed up, and so we will pull you over. Now, maybe there's mitigating circumstances. Somebody can appeal that situation and say, no, this is legitimate. This is the reason why I filed this lien. But really, we're just flagging it to say, if this is something that is not legitimate, we're putting it into this separate pile and making sure that it's not overly burdensome to the person who the lien was filed against.
Thank you. Representative Lucero, any follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. And I love that analogy. That helps with, it's just the facts. The outcome is somebody didn't use their blinker when changing lanes or whatever. Rather than getting into the intent of why they didn't use the blinker, the fact is that it's all. That helps clear it up. Thank you.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. Holland. So being somebody that uses this system all the time, I had no idea that this was occurring. And so I appreciate the bill and what it's trying to do. Just a couple of quick questions in your analogy there, and I won't use my blinker. So, you know, there are times when somebody is legitimately using UCC in a financing statement. So we put that in that pile, as you just said, that we question. I take it that is still going to be in effect if indeed Secretary of State's office does find out that this is a legitimate one and, you know, a legitimate filing and going to give that individual the opportunity to ensure that they can provide the proof to a legitimate filing. Can you just walk through how that's going to work? Are the guardrails in place to ensure that the legitimate ones aren't getting missed in the system?
Representative Hollins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Farr. That's a great question. And yes, that is the intent, that the legitimate ones will continue to process as usual. Only the ones that get flagged will be put into this separate pile. And it's not that this separate pile will be destroyed or eradicated in any way, because we want folks to be able to have the opportunity to appeal that if they really feel that this is something that is legitimate, and to bring their case forward to say, no, there's a reason why this is filed. As far as the specifics on how that will be done, I will turn it over to Ms. Freeman, because she'll have a better idea of how the Secretary of State office actually functions on a day-to-day.
Ms. Freeman.
Thanks so much, Chair and Representative. Yes, so there is an appeals process. So when a filing were to come in under this bill, and it was put in that set-aside pile deemed as fraudulent, a notice, our office is required to give the filer notice within 2 business days, essentially that their filing was rejected. And that notice will give them information on what the appeals process is. If they did appeal it and it was deemed as legitimate and sort of overturned, they would keep their line in priority, and the lien would sort of retroactively be in effect at the time that they filed it. So. It's sort of a way to like rewind the tape in a not eloquent way to explain it, to rewind the tape and say, you know, we're starting, the clock starts when you file it, similar to if it never got set aside in that questionable pile.
Representative Farr, any follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. Just one follow-up. So I'm being biased, but I'm assuming that any lending institution that makes a filing would never get put in that pile, right? You know, for example, I mean, obviously it's not raising the red flags that we're talking about here, and so there would be no issue for that. Obviously, they all have proof of their filing and a security agreement that goes along with that. But you know, I'm just asking the question maybe more on a personal level, that I assume that if a bank is making this filing, it would never be put in that separate pile and be looked at. Is that fair?
Or Representative Hollins?
No, I will defer to Ms. Freeman on this.
Ms. Freeman.
Sure. So I don't want to say definitively one way, you know, one filing would or one filing wouldn't. But what might be helpful is to kind of list some of the clearly fraudulent filing that we see right now, some of those characteristics. So a few of them are that they list the same name for both the debtor and the secured party. Some of them use a red ink thumbprint to represent the blood oath. Frequently, they have an excessive number of pages, like hundreds and hundreds. I know I spoke with Trudy earlier today, and she had a filing that was, you know, like this thick. That would fall probably under this provision. They add additional designations like L or BEY to party names. they lack any physical address, or will add additional punctuation to an address, like near the town of Stillwater, Minnesota, for example. Sometimes they reference the Bible, the Constitution. They might include other, like, personal documents, like a birth certificate, social security cards, like a bunch of personal documents that you wouldn't want in a public filing. Signatures might be followed by the word sovereign living souls. So there's some, like, telltale signs that are out there. And so I think for an entity that frequently files legitimate filings, they likely, yeah, I don't want to say, I guess I want to hold back and not say yes or no, but that there are some characteristics that we will, that our office sort of has identified in these harassment and fraudulent filings.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Representative Farr, any further follow-up?
Yeah, real quick, just thank you for that. I appreciate that, and I understand what you're saying there. And just so you know, at the bank, we stopped using the blood oath years ago, so we don't do that any longer. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank heavens on that. Members, any further discussion? All right. Seeing none, I will give Representative Hollins the chance to make final comments before we move to a vote.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Committee. Representative Farr, I'm so glad that you don't use blood oaths anymore. That's a relief. I would really recommend a yes vote on this. This is very common sense, and it really protects all of us from bad actors who are using our state resources and systems maliciously. And it's an easy way that we can protect folks and not infringe upon anybody's rights in any sort of serious way. So I encourage a yes vote. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3400 be recommended to be re-referred to the public safety. I'm going to double check with RCA here because originally it was the general register. All right, thank you very much. I will renew my motion that House File 3400 be recommended to be placed on the general register. And the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Chair Cotizza-Watoon.
Aye.
Cotizza-Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, aye.
O'Driscoll, aye. Representative Barr.
No.
Barr, no. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson, aye. Representative Daphne.
Daphne, aye.
Daphne, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, aye.
Haley, aye. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Lislegard, aye. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, yes.
Lucero, aye. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
Farr, aye.
Farr, yeah, aye. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Richardson, aye. And Representative Tice.
Tice, aye.
Tice, aye.
There being 17 ayes and one nay, the motion prevails and House File 3400 is recommended to be placed on the general register. Next, we have House File 3403, Chair Stevenson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 3403 be recommended to be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee.
Chair Stevenson moves that House File 3403 be recommended to be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. It looks like you have an A2 amendment. Would you like to move and describe the A2?
Yes, the A2 amendment makes some technical changes. It also changes the fee structure in accordance to some feedback we heard from Representatives Nash and Drazkowski in the last committee. It ensures that if there is a fee paid on the front end for the service, that fee is ultimately deducted from the real fee you have to pay when you apply for the license, which might make more sense after I explain the bill later, but keep that filed away.
Very good. Members, any discussion to the A2 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to speak quickly here because I know our time is limited. This bill enables people to get a pre-licensing review of their criminal history by agencies that license for professions, whether you want to be, mortgage person or a nurse or anything else, one of the various licensed jobs that we professions we have in the state. You might not be able to do that under our existing law because of a criminal conviction. I want to be clear that this bill does not change any of the eligibility for any job. If you are ineligible to hold a job because of a criminal conviction or be in a profession, have a license before this bill, you would still be ineligible after this bill passes. What this bill does is it makes it so that you can go to the licensing agency before you get the education and the training you would need to get the license and find out if you are eligible, thus potentially saving yourself a lot of time, energy, and money for a job that you are not eligible for because of a criminal conviction. A lot of agencies do this already on an informal basis. This standardizes and formalizes it. It's had bipartisan support in the committees it's been to so far, and I hope we turn it here as well. And I think there are a number of people who wish to speak to the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. And we do have a number of testifiers today, as well as a couple of bills left on the agenda. So if testifiers could keep their testimony to about 2 minutes, that would be much appreciated. First on the list, I have Melissa Forbes. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Megan Forbes. I think there's also a Melissa who's on to testify today, too.
My apologies.
That's okay. I just wanted to make sure you have the right person.
Megan Forbes.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm legislative counsel at the Institute for Justice. We're a nonprofit that works to protect civil liberties and to reduce barriers to earning a living. We've been working in partnership with the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition, the Justice Action Network, and the Council of State Governments Justice Center to advance this bill that creates better transparency in the state licensure process. We're very grateful to Chair Stevenson for taking the lead on this legislation and for the committee for hearing this bill today. The bill requires state agencies and licensing boards to offer a preliminary application process so that a person with a criminal record can learn at any time, including before submitting a complete application for licensure, whether their criminal record disqualifies them from getting a license. We think this is a really positive reform. It's a reform that many states have taken. 20 states in total have this reform in place that creates this clear, transparent process for people to get a license. This formalizes, as Chair Stevenson said, something that many agencies are already doing to some extent, but right now there is no formal ability for people to get this determination. So it's very important that people have this ability moving forward. Overall, we think this bill will be something that will benefit employers who are looking to address workforce shortages right now. We also think that it'll help support families. It will help increase access to good paying jobs, family stability, and reduce recidivism. We thank you for your consideration of this bill today.
Thank you, Ms. Forbes. Next, we have Alex Reeves. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Alex Reeves. At first glance, I probably just look like your typical mom of two. I work from home full time in the mental health field, and I admit that I watch way too many true crime documentaries in my free time. What you wouldn't assume about me is that I actually have a criminal history, and I spent 2 years in prison. My ex-husband had a Ponzi scheme, and out of his 2.5-year run, I knew about it for 6 months. And by the laws of the federal government, that makes me a co-conspirator because I didn't report him to law enforcement. I was getting my master's degree before I went to prison. I wanted to work with an inmate population going all the way back to my bachelor's degree. I was pursuing a master's degree in forensic psychology with a concentration in forensic assessment. And now that I have a criminal history, it's been a challenge to continue my master's degree. Not only because the applications for school asked me about criminal convictions, But even worse, I am unsure if I would even qualify for a license, even when I finished my required education. I've emailed the state of Minnesota to know if I would be disqualified from getting a license because of my conviction, and especially related to the specific license that I'd be applying for, but they didn't get me any criteria to know whether my conviction would be considered related or not. The state told me if all else fails, I could submit a special consideration for a license, but that would mean I would have to get the degree to even be considered. Essentially, I would have to run a marathon, and I wouldn't even know what the prize is until I got to the end. This bill would make it possible for me to know ahead of time whether or not my conviction would disqualify me for a license before I spend the time and the money to go back to finish my master's degree. I hope you will pass this bill because there are people with criminal backgrounds who were put in really difficult situations, and they're not necessarily their convictions, and they deserve a chance at their dream careers without the unnecessary barriers. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing your experience, Ms. Reeves. Next, we have Melissa Reed. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Melissa Reed, and I am here today on behalf of the Justice Action Network, the nation's largest bipartisan criminal justice organization that works throughout the country and in Washington to advance bipartisan reforms that make our criminal justice system smarter, fairer, more efficient, and more effective. The Justice Action Network is pleased to testify in support of House File 3403, which establishes a preclearance process to aid potential applicants with a criminal history so they may know if they are summarily ineligible for a desired license solely based on this history prior to making substantial educational and entrepreneurial investments. Transparency and clarity regarding the impact of one's criminal history on potential professional paths is critical to Minnesota workers and employers, now more than ever. We cannot afford to leave anyone on the bench, particularly those who are proactively seeking access to wealth-building, family-sustaining jobs that often require an occupational license. National estimates find that unlicensed workers earn 10 to 15% lower wages than licensed workers with similar levels of education, training, and experience, leading to increased income inequality and reduced socioeconomic mobility. Today, 25 to 30% of workers must have a license or some other form of permission to work, and that is up from 5% in the 1950s. Recognizing the significant economic and social need to reducing restrictive occupational licensing and increasing transparency reform in this area has been truly bipartisan, both in the states and at the federal level. Both the Obama and Trump administrations led significant reform initiatives related to occupational licensing, voluntary certifications, cost benefit of license laws, harmonizing regulatory requirements, and interstate portability. Since 2015, 38 states and Washington, D.C. have increased transparency and licensing for individuals with criminal histories. 19 states and Washington, D.C., individuals with criminal histories have a preclearance process to apply to state licensors at any time prior to enrolling in required educational or training programs. By enacting this legislation, Minnesota will join other states in establishing an important preclearance process that will allow those seeking best good jobs the information they need to make smart, informed decisions about their educational and employment endeavors. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Reed. Finally, we have Peter Brickwitty, the Department of Commerce. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Commerce. I'll keep my remarks brief. I just want to thank Representative Stevenson for bringing this bill forward. Members may be aware that the department is a significant licensor with hundreds of thousands of individuals and businesses licensed across 20 different industries, or more than 20 different industries to do business in the state of Minnesota. And we've been very grateful to be able to work with the advocates, some of whom you've heard from today, who have incorporated some technical advice that the department had to make this bill function as efficiently as possible for the individuals who will hopefully be able to take advantage of the preliminary application process. I just wanted to note two things for the committee. The department has, in part of our work, primarily in the real estate and insurance sectors, an informal process that looks very similar to this bill, but I think this is very much in line with our department's strategic plan to look for and examine ways that we can ameliorate obstacles to becoming licensed so that people in Minnesota can do work and do business in our state in the fields that we regulate. And second, we do have a number of license types or registration types, I should say more accurately, primarily in, issued by our financial institutions division that does not have this informal process in place. And so we do anticipate that there will be some increase. I think that's actually the hope of the bill, that we'll have more people applying for licensure or moving through this preliminary application process. So we do believe that we'll have some small amount of cost to do work that we wouldn't otherwise have, but we'll be working with the chair on that moving forward. So thank you again to Representative Stevenson for bringing this forward, and happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Brickwitty. Members, any discussion? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple of quick things on this. This bill does have, in my opinion, some practical applications. Someone who works in the providing education in regulated industries in the state of Minnesota, I can tell you that a number of students, as they get into their training, ask me the question. You talked about a felony that will preclude us from well, we have to report that, criminal activity. And they want me to kind of be the arbiter of those things, and I cannot do that. Or someone who is pursuing a career, find out whether or not they're eligible for licensure makes a lot of sense in saving a student money and or an applicant money in this. The thing I also need to go on the record is just because you become eligible for licensure does not guarantee that an employer is going to hire you. I have talked to folks in the law enforcement industry, in the profession. They've indicated that they have folks who have criminal activity. While they may be licensed, they may not be hired by the agency because the agency is not in a position to want to have folks who have some other problems associated with that, so from their background. So I think that this bill does have a good value for consumers here in the state of Minnesota, and I plan on voting yes for the bill today.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to voice my strong support for this bill. I've asked to be added as a co-author on it. I think this is an important step that we can take to make sure that individuals who have, you know, who have a criminal background are able to get streamlined and timely responses to their opportunities available to them in these really important occupations. And so appreciate the bipartisan work on this, and I hope we can get this bill passed this session. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess my question is for the bill author. So, being one that is both a licensed real estate agent, so through Commerce, and a licensed builder, so through Dolly, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but do you have insight, if I were to call, I've never done this, but if I were to call up either one of these two departments or any of the other regulatory bodies that license in Minnesota and ask them questions about, you know, if I have this on my background or that on my background, will I qualify? Do they currently have processes in place to give me a yes or no answer?
Chair Stevenson?
Some do, some don't. This streamlines it. The other difference that this bill would do is that if you called up and someone told you, yes, you qualify right now, and they were, you know, mistaken or something was screwed up, that's kind of your problem. This would make it a binding determination that you could rely on.
Representative Lucero, any follow-up?
Thank you. And just one quick follow-up then. So for those that I can make that phone call or have processes in place to be able to do so, the formation of this, will there be a reduction then potentially because there would be less staff required for that to happen in the current agencies that do that?
Chair Stevenson.
No, because they would just be continue doing, I mean, they would do something different, but they would continue doing it. It stays at the agency level. It doesn't all come centralized. So thank they you. Would still need the resources.
Thank you.
Members, any further discussion to the bill as amended? Chair Stevenson, final comments?
It's a good bill. Please vote for it.
Representative Stevenson renews his motion that House File 3403, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Education Finance Committee, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair, Chair Cotizo Watoon.
Aye.
Cotizo Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, aye.
O'Driscoll, aye. Representative Barr.
Barr, aye.
Barr, aye. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson, aye. Representative Daphne.
Daphne, aye.
Daphne, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, aye.
Haley, aye. Representative Cagle.
Cagle, aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Lislegard, aye. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, yes.
Lucero, aye. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
Farr, aye.
Farr, aye. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Tice.
Tice, aye.
Tice, aye.
Members, there being 18 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails and House File 3403 as amended is recommended to be re-referred to the Education Finance Committee. And I will hand the virtual gavel back to Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Vice Chair Cotizo Watoon. The next bill on the agenda is House File 3775 from Representative Daphne. Representative Daphne, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the bill. I believe the proper motion is to recommend it to pass and refer to the General Register.
Chair Daphne moves House File 3775 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. I understand you have an amendment, the A1 amendment. Would you like to move the amendment?
I would like to move the amendment, sir.
Chair Daphne moves the A1 amendment. I understand this to be an author's amendment, getting the bill in the shape that you would like to consider it. I don't know if you want to describe it further.
Mr. Chair, staff was good enough to figure out that there was a date that needed to be updated. So it's strictly a technical amendment.
Any discussion to the A1? Hearing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Daphne, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I do want to make it clear to the committee that this is my reelection bill. this is largely, Mr. Chair and members, a technical bill requested by the Department of Commerce to better support franchise owners in renewing their business registration. It changes the deadline for re-registering your business from 120 days after the end of your fiscal year to 1 year after the anniversary of the initial registration. With me today is Mr. John Kelly with the Department of Commerce.
Mr. Kelly, brief comments?
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Daphne for carrying the bill. As you can see, members, we put a one-pager about the bill, and the bill itself is not super long. I think Representative Daphne covered it. But the idea here is that it's less cumbersome to and more uniform for franchise holders. They have the full year to renew and get the franchise. So. And I believe this has pretty wide industry support. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. We do have one other testifier who signed up, David Kaufman. Mr. Kaufman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a great pleasure and an honor to appear before the Minnesota Legislature. My name is David Kaufman. I'm with the New York City law firm Kaufman, Gilden & Robbins. Have some background in this area. In a former life, I served as Special Deputy Attorney General of New York and authored New York's Franchise Act, and appear as an expert in the statute book of New York, and am the author of the franchise column in the New York Law Journal. So much for New York. The bottom line is our firm represents many of America's largest franchisors, and I really have to thank Representative Daphne for introducing HF 3775. Did I get the number right? I believe I did. As noted, franchisors, I got to tell you, the Department of Commerce in Minnesota, along with the fellow regulators from around the country, have done a remarkable job in policing franchising. For an industry that 60 years ago was equated with fraud, today it's as clean as can be, with exceptions here and there. I'm not saying it's totally clean, but the regulators in Minnesota have been vigilant protecting franchisee investors. They subject franchisors to filing requirements, update requirements, annual report requirements. And this bill goes a long way toward easing the regulatory burden on these franchisors. It does not detract one bit from the information required to be filed. It just delinks the timing of it. It used to be that you had to file by the end of April. So if you got a registration, let's say a franchise registration, without which you cannot offer or sell franchises in Minnesota. If you got your registration in December 31, 2021, under existing law, you had to go and update as of the end of April 2022. That was clearly a burden. This delinks that and makes the registration good for a year. Every major franchisor we represent, and that includes Yum Brands, which is Pizza Hut, KFC, Taco Bell, and Habit Burger Grill, 7-Eleven, and you also should have a submission received from IHG Hotels and Resorts. That's the franchisor of 14 hotel brands, including Holiday Inns, Crown Plaza, Intercontinental Hotels, and so forth. This is something very strongly supported by them. So it serves franchisors. It does not detract at all from the robust protection of franchisees that the Minnesota Franchise Act affords. And so I would respectfully suggest that this is a bill that should be passed. And I really do thank you for the opportunity to be heard. It's a very gracious invitation that I received, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Kaufman. We'll now move to to member discussion and questions. Representative Lucero.
No question, just a comment. I wanted to thank Chair Dabney for his incredible hard work and long hours into this bill, and I appreciate a Dabney bill I can support. Thank you.
Wonderful. I see no member seeking recognition. Chair Dabney, any closing comments?
Mr. Kelly and Mr. Kaufman did it well. I ask for member support.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Without further ado, he renews his motion to House File 3775 as amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. And Mr. Dockendorf will take the roll. The chair votes aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Aye.
Cotiza Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, aye.
O'Driscoll, aye. Representative Barr.
Aye.
Barr, aye. Representative Carlson.
Carlson, aye.
Carlson, aye. Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Dabney, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley.
Haley, aye.
Haley, aye. Representative Cagle.
Cagle, aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Lislegard, aye. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, yes.
Lucero, aye. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
Farr, aye.
Farr, aye. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Richardson, aye. And Representative Tice.
Tice, aye.
There being 18 ayes and 0 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 3775 is recommended to be placed on the general register. The last item on our agenda today is House File 3818. Representative Haley, would you like to move your bill?
I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Haley moves House File 3818 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus. Representative Haley, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity today. You probably recall hearing this bill in a previous session. This is something I believe that legislature really needs to address. I have a couple testifiers that want to share their personal stories of health insurance premiums in southeastern Minnesota, so I'll just take 1 minute to frame this. Our insurance rating areas were dictated by the ACA, also referred to as Obamacare. It's been 10 years since that legislation was passed, so I think it's time that the state do a study and update the process that we have used to carve up our different rating areas in the state of Minnesota. We've had significant change in the health insurance marketplace in those 10 years. We've had consolidation of healthcare providers, and we have a unique opportunity coming up in the next year with licensing for reinsurance. We will also probably have a change at the federal level with the federal tax credits either expanding or being reduced. So it's a time when we can use all this information together and look at how we are running our insurance marketplace, in particular, the individual marketplace that is most affected by these rating areas. So I would like to take the remaining time and allow my testifiers to share with you the impact on their personal lives and their businesses. And I believe that Brian and Sarah Reese from Wabasha will probably be going first. Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Haley. We can hear from Brian and you say Sarah. I only have Brian yes. on my list here, but the Freese, go ahead.
Chair, good afternoon and thank you for your time today. My name is Brian Freese and along with my wife, Sarah, we're raising three children in Wabasha, a small town in Southeast Minnesota. Back in October of 2021, my wife, frustrated with the ever-increasing cost of health insurance and healthcare, sent a handful of letters to the Capitol explaining our situation. We'd like to acknowledge Representative Haley for reaching out to us and addressing our concerns. In addition, Representative Haley then asked us to speak today in hopes that our story can help make a positive change.
In 2021, we applied but did not qualify for MNCHR tax credits, and our premiums had climbed to over $26,000 per year. Through MNCHR in 2021, we were able to pay only $20,000 per year in premiums. It was not the Cadillac of insurance, but it was something. Our family deductible was $14,000, and if you add that to the premium, it costs us $34,000 per year before insurance really kicks in. Our 2022 plan, again obtained through MNCHR, is about $24,000 per year, with a family deductible that's over $14,000. That puts our total annual cost of health insurance at nearly $38,000 a year. That's about 40% of our gross income. This is catastrophic insurance coverage with Cadillac pricing. It's too much. Even with health insurance, we could be one major illness away from financial devastation. Our daughter had an emergency appendectomy last spring. Her bill was over $28,000, and our out-of-pocket cost is $7,000. Put that in perspective, $7,000 is about half the cost of 1 year at a state university. This is not one particular health insurer. It's all of the health insurance companies. We live in rural Minnesota in Wabasha, so our health insurance options are more limited than for people who live in the metro. If we all had affordable health insurance, maybe we could save money for college education or for our retirement. We can't all work for the government or for a huge corporation that offers affordable health insurance. I think insurance costs should be the same for everyone, regardless of their zip code. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for taking the time to share your story with us. I appreciate it very much. I also have Ann and Dan Buck on the list. Are the Bucks here? There they are.
Yes, hi, this is Ann and Dan Buck, and we thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for this opportunity. We have a family dairy farm together with our two sons in Southeast Minnesota, rural Goodyew. Goodyew is located between Red Wing and Rochester, or Red Wing and Zumbrota. When ACA Obamacare was implemented, our health insurance rates skyrocketed because we were self-employed farmers that had to buy individual plans. We had few options. It was also true with other small businesses. Our rates are dictated by our zip code. My husband Dave will talk about how these rates changed Obamacare.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having us. I priced some rates with our local insurance agent, and I'll apologize. These are 2021 rates, but I don't think they've gone down, I'm guessing. For Goodyew County, husband, wife, and we had one son on it then was $100 a month. That was a $4,200 deductible. Dakota County, it was $1,555 for the same plan. I priced, there was an alternative that kind of went into the health insurance business because of the high rates, but it turned out their plans were similarly priced, which leads me to believe that this can't be blamed on the insurance companies, I don't think. The problem is the zip code and how that defines your rates. Literally, you could live in Goodhue County, move across your road into Dakota County, and your rates would probably be $1,000 a month cheaper. This makes absolutely no sense to me. I'm not sure how they justify this. The income cliff, I think they have addressed that somewhat. And like I said, I didn't check on this year's, but now the one year we checked, you could go, they had such a sharp drop off. If you went over the income, you were responsible for such a large portion of the insurance, which also made no sense. One other thing I will bring up, and I don't know if you can do much about this, but, and maybe it was my fault, when I was on MnSure looking for rates and trying to figure out what we were going to do, I was about done, and my phone rang, and it was insurance company, and I had over 20 calls within 24 hours of people trying to call or sell me insurance, and it went on for maybe 3-4 days. I'm not sure if it was a requirement for me to put my phone number in them when I was searching, but if it is, I would like that requirement removed. They can contact us by letter if they want to reach us as far as selling insurance. Thank you.
Thank you to both Mr. and Ms. Buck, and thanks for the additional feedback. We have our next speakers from the Department of Commerce. Perhaps they can take that into account. Julia Dreyer is Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce. Commissioner Dreyer.
Yes, thank you, Chair Stevenson, for the opportunity to speak today. I'm going to try to keep this super brief. I just want to note that we have spoken with Representative Haley, and we will continue to work with her on these issues. There will be a fiscal note to perform the work. I also want to note that because of how the rating area are, how the rating areas are structured, there are always winners and losers, no matter how we structure the rating areas. But also want to note that the tax credit, additional tax credits that Congress passed as part of the American Rescue Plan have played a big role in what people have paid this year relative to what the rates actually are. Certainly happy to take questions, but also cognizant of time. So I will keep my remarks to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Dreyer. Representative Haley, I know you were deferring to your testifiers. I just want to turn it back to you now before we have a good discussion to see if you wanted to add any more since we have a couple minutes here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the Commerce Department who has been very helpful in discussions with me as we've worked on this bill the last number of sessions. This is really an economic development issue for the entire state of Minnesota. These high rates that are well over, 50% above what people might pay in the metro don't just impact southeastern Minnesota, but they impact all of rural Minnesota. And I think you would all agree with me, the two most important things when you decide where to live is, will your kids have good schools? When will you have healthcare close to home that you can afford? So if we can't solve this issue for rural Minnesota, we won't have people that can stay and live and work and have a small business, have a farm like the Fries and like the Buck family are doing. So, as I said, I'm very appreciative of Commerce's support, and I would like to see us have this included in Chair Stevenson's bill this year so that we can begin to move this forward and have information that will just help us as a state see if there's a better way of doing this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Haley, for bringing the bill and for your relentless pursuit of this bill. I appreciate it. I was glad we were able to include it in our bill last year. I was unhappy that the Senate would not accept it last year, but I'm certainly game for trying again this year. With that, I think we will lay the bill over for possible inclusion. And that concludes today's agenda. And so the hearing is adjourned.